Blog Talk Radio.
Tuning in to another episode of Movie Geeks United this Sunday evening. Tonight we have director David Cronenberg, one of the most unique and influential voices in cinema for the past, going on 30 years. We've got him tonight talking about his new film, A Dangerous Method, and so many other great. What's your favorite Cronenberg?
That's a good question. I mean, I would have to go with maybe A History of Violence, or I might even go with Spider recently. I don't know, all-time favorite, though? That's a tough one. Videodrome, probably.
Right.
Or, I like The Fly, I like Dead Ringers, and I like Naked Lunch a lot. There's Shivers, right? That's an old
mm-hmm.
one. And what was it? Did he do Rabid? Was
yes.
that him? That's a crazy film.
Wasn't that Oliver Reed? Was Oliver Reed in that?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, that was early on. I'm crazy about The Fly.
Yeah, no, The Fly's a good one.
Yeah. So he will be joining us a little bit later on in the show to tell us all about his new
movie. Oh, The
Death
Zone.
Oh, yeah.
That's one of my all-time favorites, actually.
Mine, too. I mean,
yeah.
That's definitely my favorite. Well, since we did The Shining, it's
definitely, I don't know if you want to say
one or two of the top my top favorite Stephen King movies. You know, and I think it's overlooked, and I don't know why I overlook it, because it's so emotional, and it's the best Christopher Walken performance, I think. It's a phenomenal movie. Anyway, he will be joining us a little bit later on in the show to discuss his new movie.
Cool.
This weekend, I guess the big news in the movie stratosphere is the new Twilight movie.
But does it surprise anyone, though? I mean, I haven't seen it yet, so I don't know. But does it surprise
you? Didn't rush out to see that?
No, I've seen the others, but I haven't seen this one, man. But I heard it's the best of the lot. That's not hard, though. They keep saying that with each progressive movie. But
who did the last? Who directed the last one?
David Slade did the last one, so that was actually the first like semi-decent one. But I mean, the bar was set so low, I mean, you know.
And this is Bill Condon.
Yeah, this is Bill Condon. Actually, though, the reviews have been somewhat positive for these kind of films, so.
Yeah. Well, it opened at just under $140 million. For those that didn't know if I was saying $140,000 or million, there you go.
I like $140,000. That's funny.
Making it the fifth highest grossing opening of all time. I'm sure it'll have legs.
Do you think it will have legs? Because Wednesday, you have a lot of things coming up to, you have the Muppet movie of Arthur Christmas, but it's not only that. I mean, I think it will do well into the holiday weekend. I think after that, though, I mean, I think these things are so front-loaded.
That's right. I think the Thanksgiving holiday is a benefit to it.
It always has been.
Yeah, I think it's definitely going to last for the week.
What else if it says? Oh, Hugo, though. There's Hugo.
Hugo, yeah. Now, what about the Muppets?
Well, I mean,
are kids into the Muppets still? I don't know.
It's not aimed at kids.
Right.
It's really,
it's
I don't
donors,
think it's aimed
right?
at kids. I think it's aimed more at my age group and at like younger generation. It's not aimed at kids because, you know, listen, like Frank Oz has nothing to do with this, I think. And, you know, some people were very upset with Jason Segel because they didn't want him attached to this because, you know, they were on Saturday Night Live last night.
Right.
Jason Segel and the Muppets in the opening, the monologue. You know, they thought, oh, my God, this is going to, like, they're like tarnishing the Muppets. So, you know, there's been some controversy about this.
Mm.
But I think it's got a great cast. I mean, it's a very hip cast, and I think, you know, it might, is a possibility it could do well. I mean, I really do think that.
Yeah. Well, I don't, yeah. What was the last one?
One the one where they go into space, or?
Oh, that could
it's
be.
It's been a long time, I think, since they've had
I forgot that. I know the Manhattan thing.
Well,
and they go to New York.
That was decades ago, man.
And they meet Jason Voorhees there. And then the one with Michael Caine, The Christmas Carol, The Muppet Christmas Carol.
Yeah, these are all
Carol.
That's the 90s. I think that was 92 or 93 or something.
Yeah. Well, they haven't had a movie out in a long time.
Yeah,
right?
It's been, the last thing I think was Muppets in Space, which was 99, I think, so.
Mm. That's a question mark. But so is Hugo.
Hugo is a big question mark.
Yeah.
Who knows?
I hope it's a success for him.
Yeah, no, of course.
I see it tomorrow night, so hopefully it'll be a success for him. I did see something this weekend that I suppose we can discuss before we bring on Mr. Cronenberg.
I think it'd be the perfect thing to talk about before Cronenberg.
Okay. I finally checked out Melancholia Friday night.
Right.
So, I think Von Trier is a really talented guy.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's got a great visual sense. I just never like what he says in any of his movies.
Well, what do you think he's saying in this movie?
Well, okay. Well, people read it as like a good parallel to Tree of Life. And I think that it's like the anti-Tree of Life.
I think it's
because,
just as beautiful as Tree of Life, if not more so.
Well, it's beautiful to look at. You think the message
is beautiful?
Beautiful?
I mean, dude, if that's the way it's going to go, if that's the way it's going to happen, well, that's a lot better than I imagine something far, far more sinister. It's actually, I almost think it's a beautiful. You have this cosmic destruction, and it's just like really beautiful.
And we're talking about the end of the world. The movie is about
a planet
colliding.
Giving
no, I don't think everyone does, but it's about a planet colliding with ours, and So, you think it's a beautiful rendering?
I think it's the most beautiful thing he's done, and I think it's by far his best film since Dancer in the Dark, because after Dancer in the Dark, he makes some wretched films. I mean, Dogville and Manderley. I mean, you're asking people to pay money to see a film shot in a high school gymnasium, essentially? Come on. Come on. Give me a fucking break.
Well, what about Bring It On?
Well, Bring It On. Now, that's an awesome film. Bring It On is an awesome, very funny
film.
That's
a high school gymnasium movie, right?
Yeah, but it takes place all over the place. But that's just an awesome fucking film. That's a funny fucking movie. Who knew they'd get, like, four sequels out of that?
Anyway, so Melancholia. It seemed to be saying to me that anything we kind of value in life, the love of a partner, the love of your family, the certainty of science, it means nothing in the end.
Well, I think he's on to something there because, I mean, it's sort of like the thinking person's knowing then, I mean, is what you're trying to say. In a way, in that silly Nicolas Cage movie from a couple of years ago. But in a way, yeah, he is. I mean, he's basically taking a very secular view on life.
That doesn't have anything to do with Christianity or God or a higher power or any of that.
No, but he's just saying it just means, but he means every, it just, I agree with you there. He is saying it really just in the end, I mean, it means nothing. It's a very nihilistic viewpoint. I mean, you couldn't be any more nihilistic, but I see where he's coming from because this is there in all the movies, even Antichrist, which I was not crazy about, but this one, I think he manages to get. He goes after. This group of people, very well off, very wealthy. People at first you really don't care about, but then, you know, the two sisters I think you do care about and the kid, I think you do grow to care about them, but it just, to him, it's just like, we're here and then we're gone.
Yeah.
I can appreciate that. I don't know if I believe that as much as I once did, but I can certainly appreciate that viewpoint.
Yeah. Well, I think anyone that... I don't know. I don't share that worldview, and I think that anyone that makes movies with that worldview is a hypocrite. Why would you make movies?
Well, it's Lars. It's a man who's... Look, I'm probably one of the few people who, even though it was a dumb, stupid thing to say,
I
understood the point he was trying to make, but it's not the point. It's not the kind of thing, how he says, my brother would say, you don't share that with people. You don't share that in public. But I understood the point that he was trying to make, the infamous Hitler remark. I understood that perfectly. But it's not the kind of thing that you say in public, so especially not a press conference. You just don't blurt that out.
Well, I think he's the kind of guy that would only say that in a press conference.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with that. But I do, I mean, who are some other filmmakers that you would say at another time would have made made this kind of movie? There are others. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, there are others, but I mean, this is just such a, but I think this is everything he's been trying to say, and he finally does it perfectly. And it's just, but that's one reading of the film. I mean, I think there are a lot of readings of the film. You could say it's a movie against materialism, a movie against the, you know, this is, the, you could make the argument this movie is a indictment of the wealthy. I mean, he's really putting it on there. I mean, he really goes after them. And also, let's be very honest, this is, I think, the best Kirsten Dunst has been since Marie Antoinette, and before that, The Virgin Suicides.
She's very good. I mean, the performances are very good.
I think the performances are first rate, if not... poor Charlotte Rampling.
Yeah, and you know,
Kiefer
Sutherland's in a good movie, you know,
yeah.
24.
Yeah.
It's... I had something in mind to say about it, and it just left me. It is very authentic about clinical depression.
Oh, yeah.
But where it goes seems to indicate that she's not depressed. She's just she's a realist.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, depressed is really the only way to approach, you know, your existence on this planet.
I've heard that for a long time. I agreed with it for a long time. I don't know if I agree with that as much as I once did. From someone who suffers from mild depressions now and then. There are people who I've talked and people I've grown up with and everything and just in school and at work. Yeah, I mean, if you really do think about it, that may be the only, I think in certain phases of our lives, that is the only way sometimes to really approach things and to view the world realistically. And if realism equals depression.
I just don't...
Dude, it's cool. I mean, it's a...
Why would you live?
Well, that's just it. Why would you live? Now we're getting into really deep philosophical questions here. Why would you live? We should invite Woody Allen on the show, for crying out loud.
Well, yeah, I cannot wait to see that documentary about him tonight.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll talk about that in a little bit. But, it's so clear that he's... Because he sets all these things up, like all the things that we use to comfort ourselves,
mm-hmm.
love, family, science,
mm-hmm.
you know, anything we latch on to get some kind of certitude on,
right.
you know, what it's all about. It means nothing, and I think it's more than I know. We've seen horror movies that seem mm-hmm. to say that kind of thing, but. I think he believes that, and I would have, I thought it would have been a better movie if the sister
mm-hmm.
had the certitude of knowing it's all right because I have the love of my family with me at the end,
right?
And for that to parallel with Kirsten Dunst, but as it stands now, they switch roles.
Mm-hmm.
She becomes the really anxious, depressed one at the end, and she has this calm about her
right.
at the end. She's prepared for it, and the scientist just checks out, like as soon as the impending doom
right.
rears its head. Yeah, it's an interesting movie, but I think it's an interesting movie for a very good reason. I wish every movie was like this,
mm-hmm.
in that it makes you kind of discuss what the movie is saying.
Mm-hmm.
And too few movies actually do that. So what I appreciate.
You
the
don't
movie.
Think
I
Jack don't... and Jill? You don't think Jack and Jill?
Well, I mean, Jack and Jill does make a great argument for being realistic about clinical depression. Yeah, you should be depressed. If this is what we got going on, you should be depressed.
Mm-hmm.
So while I don't necessarily I appreciate the movie, while I don't necessarily like it, I do appreciate the fact that it inspires conversation.
Right. Okay.
About what it's saying. And I do have more concrete thoughts about that than Antichrist.
Yeah, Antichrist was just, I don't know. I thought this was light years ahead of Antichrist.
Yeah, I do too, actually. I do too. Anyway, okay, let's get to our first interview tonight. A Dangerous Method is the film, Mr. Cronenberg's latest. Stars Viggo Mortensen, Michael Fassbender, Keira Knightley. It's about the relationship between Freud and Jung in the earliest days of psychoanalysis and the woman that comes between them. It opens, when does it open, Limited?
It opens November 23rd, this Wednesday, Limited.
Wednesday.
And I think it
wow.
starts in the middle of December, it will expand.
It's crowded holiday season, man.
Oh, it's a very crowded holiday season. But I wonder if there's going to be
good
a lot
stuff.
Of limited, a lot of limited releases, and then in January you're going to have
yeah.
this thing because you have a lot of big, just big movies coming out in January, just not Oscar related, but just they're throwing everything in January this year.
Yeah, yeah.
It's going to be very crowded in the next 2 months.
But this is getting rave reviews. It's a great, great film, great performances of Viggo Mortensen. Particularly that we haven't seen before. He plays Freud. It's a fascinating performance from him. We talked to Mr. Cronenberg about what drew him to the movie, some other aspects of the film, his relationship with Howard Shore, his longtime composer, who's been with him from pretty much the very beginning. That's a long... People talk about Williams and Spielberg. Shore and Cronenberg have been together almost as long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
And then we ask him about the sequel to The Fly that he wants to do.
Cool.
So here is Mr. Cronenberg. Enjoy, guys.
Pity. I should never have sent Otto Groves to you. I blame myself.
Now, I'm very grateful you did. All those provocative discussions helped crystallize a lot of my thinking.
Did he really send you his hotel bill?
Only for a couple of nights.
He's an addict. I can see that now. He can only end by doing great harm to our movement. You realize this makes you undisputed crown prince, don't you? My son and heir.
I'm not sure I deserve such an accolade.
Don't say another word. I often take my walk up here. Inspired some of my best ideas.
Part of what interests me about your motivations for the types of movies that you choose to make is that you've said you don't necessarily know. Part of the reason why you make a movie is to figure out why you were drawn to make that movie to begin with.
That's
so
right.
Having reached the end of this journey, what do you know about those motivations that you didn't know when you first embarked on it?
Sure. Of course, it might not be the end yet. It might not be at the end of the journey yet, but because it's in truth, weirdly enough, it's when you do interviews about your movie that you start to have to articulate these things, because normally you maybe would not bother to or try to articulate them. So I think I have a friend who reminded me that the first film I ever made was a 7-minute short called Transfer, and it was about a psychiatrist and his patient. So obviously this relationship that was new with Freud, that Freud invented, the relationship between an analyst and his patient, was a fascinating one to me, a sort of strange, interesting one, an invented relationship that doesn't come sort of naturally, let's say, out of the family or anything else. It's a kind of an intellectually constructed relationship. You have someone going to a complete stranger and then being asked to be incredibly articulate about the most intimate kind of things. And then you have the phenomenon of transference, where the patient starts to project onto the analyst emotions and relationships that he or she has with people in her life. And then that gets kind of complicated. So this is a very intriguing as I say, new relationship that had never existed before, and then evolved in many ways as various splinter groups from Freud's psychoanalytic group developed their own versions of that relationship, and so on and so on. But anyway, so I think in essence that's really what was intriguing me about psychoanalysis. And then when you add to that the charisma and the passion and the intellect of all of the characters in this movie, which is kind of an unusual thing, their ideas were never just abstractions for them. They were really passionate obsessions that they felt could alter lives and for the better, and that they tried to embed these things into the way they live their lives, and that too dramatically is very intriguing and very unusual.
I don't think you have any notion of the true strengths and depths of the opposition to our work. There's the whole medical establishment, of course, baying to send Freud to the auto da fe, but that is nothing compared to what happens when our ideas begin to trickle through in whatever garbled form they're relayed to the public. The denials, the frenzy, the incoherent rage.
But might that not be caused by your insistence in the exclusively sexual interpretation of the clinical material?
All I'm doing is pointing out what experience indicates to me must be the truth. And I can assure you that in 100 years' time, our work will still be rejected. Columbus, you know, had no idea what country he'd discovered. Like him, I'm in the dark. All I know is I've set foot on the shore, and the country exists.
I think of you more as Galileo, and your opponents as those who condemned him while refusing even to put their eye to his telescope.
In any event, I've simply opened a door. It's for young men like yourself to walk through it.
I'm sure you have many more doors to open for us.
Well, I've read that you've been a great admirer of Freud. And I'm curious what you see in his work and what he represents. Does that inform your creative sensibilities in any way?
Well, first of all, Freud was a wonderful writer. And in fact, at a certain point, he was being considered for the Nobel Prize, and they weren't sure whether they should give it to him for literature or for science. That just lets you know where he was with his talent. It considered some of the most beautiful German ever written. But I think anybody growing up in the 20th century, being formed in the late 20th century, will have been influenced by Freud, whether he knows it or not. You know, just our understanding of human psychology, of the human condition. So much of that comes from Freud, even when we're not aware of it. It's sort of in the air you breathe, you know, part of the zeitgeist. And so I will have been influenced by Freud in that sense. There are artists like Bernardo Bertolucci, for example, who says that he actually uses psychoanalytic method in structuring his movies, and of course the surrealists, Salvador Dali and so on, really use Freud's dream interpretation techniques as part of their sort of tools of their art. I don't go that far, you know. It's not conscious. Let's put it that way. That's a good Freudian term. It would be a subconscious or unconscious.
You mentioned the in your first answer about the relationship between the psychiatrist and the patient, in that the patient comes in and they have to be completely open. I'm thinking about the brave performances that show up in your films time and time again, and Keira Knightley in this film, it's an incredibly brave, bold performance. And I think of movies like Crash and for you as a filmmaker, what do you do to create an environment that's conducive to giving that actor that amount of freedom to give that kind of performance?
Right. Well, I think it's two things. It's a combination of excitement and safety. It's a challenge. It'll be a role in a movie that is a challenge to an actor, something that he maybe or she has never played before. But then the safety of me, my attitude to acting, and the way that I run the set, the film set, gives the actor the feeling that he can do, try things, and will, you know, make mistakes, be extreme, pull back, suggest things and never be punished or humiliated or anything like that, as long as it's a real collaboration and it's not sort of a neurotic thing, and I must say I really haven't run into that, then it's a wonderful, safe, creative collaboration. And, I mean, even to the extent that, you know, I have monitors everywhere in the set, and actors are totally free to look at them if they want to. You know, this is some directors who are very possessive of the monitor and the image, and they don't really want to share it. I don't feel that way. I feel that it's for the whole crew to be involved in the film in minute detail, and that goes for the actors as well. So it's that combination.
Well, and you have in this film, there's this delicious, very kind of stimulating and fascinating ménage à trois going on, and it's not all sexual among all three, of course.
Yeah.
But how essential was it to kind of establish relationships between those actors before you started shooting?
Mm-hmm. Totally not important, actually. Well, in the sense that the realities of movie making, especially if you're working with stars of any magnitude, is that you don't have access to them very often. I long ago discovered that I hate rehearsals, and I find them completely useless, because I find that once you get on the set, you know, rehearsals in the sort of stage style where everybody sits around a table and they all read the script to each other and make comments and so on, I found that to be not very productive for me. So I don't rehearse with the actors, and therefore I've never heard the lines of dialogue actually spoken until we're actually shooting the movie. You know, we're at least blocking the scene. You call it blocking the scene, but it's not really rehearsing. It's sort of working out how people will move through a room, for example, where they will say their lines and what they will do. And I like that, and I like the spontaneity of that and the danger of that, because I'm not prepped. I don't do storyboards. I just, you know, we just go on the set and we start to feel the scene. Now, people talk about chemistry, you know, between actors a lot, and it is an interesting and intriguing thing and a necessary thing. But how do you, as a director, know that your actors will have chemistry? For example, Michael Fassbender and Keira Knightley, I've never seen them in the movie together, in a movie together, because they've never done one together. They don't know each other. I only talk to them separately. Until I actually see them in the room together doing the scene, I don't know what the chemistry is going to be between them. So there's no rules, there's no guidebook for you as a director. You know, this kind of casting element is extremely important part of directing, but it's kind of invisible. Nobody really thinks much about it. But in fact, casting is very tricky. And, you know, you can kill your movie by miscasting it before you've shot a foot of film.
Yeah. But to hear you describe it, I know a lot of filmmakers, and a lot of filmmakers do this out of budgetary concerns, I'm sure, but they tend to make their movie before they even make their movie. Your approach, it allows you to be a lot more instinctual on set.
Yeah, well, but you see, at the same time, I've really simplified the way I shoot movies now, and we actually came in way under schedule on Dangerous Method, even though I shot everything that I felt I needed to shoot. So with maturity, with experience, you can be incredibly efficient, and also, I mean, I'm sure you feel it, but the movie has the feeling of great control. You know, it has a feeling that everything is where it should be and that it was very well thought out. And of course, you do a lot of prep, even given the way I'm talking about the way I shoot. You know, you've cast the movie, you've found the locations, you've built the sets, you've designed the costumes, and you've played with the props, and you've figured out which cigar Ford will smoke and how and when and how, you know, all of that stuff. So when I come to the set with the actors, it's not as though we have no idea what's going on, but we haven't really figured out what lens we're going to use, how we're going to light it, how I'm going to cover the scene, or how the actors will block the scene, how they'll move through the scene. And that's really where the actors contribute a huge amount. If you do storyboards, for example, which are usually done before you've even cast the movie, then you're moving the actors around like pawns, sort of to match what you did in your storyboards. In other words, you're sort of making like a comic book version of your movie. To me, that really is cutting out the collaboration of a lot of people, and I, especially your actors. And I think, why would I cast incredibly wonderful, creative actors and then not let them have input into how they, you know, how they act the scenes? That's the way it
exactly.
feels to me, anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you'd mentioned chemistry, and one of the great examples of chemistry in your own career has been between yourself and Howard Shore.
Yeah.
And we had the pleasure of speaking to Mr. Shore. And I'm wondering from you, how do you define what makes that relationship work?
Well, music is a mysterious thing because it's really beyond articulation. It's beyond language. You know, that's why it's so intriguing and why it has such visceral and emotional and sort of time-binding elements. That by which I mean, you know, if you hear a song, let's say, that's from your youth, it kind of brings back incredible floods of emotion and feelings that you had at the time, you know, when you first discovered that song. And yet it's very difficult to talk about that kind of thing. And so with a composer that you're working with as a director, it's really great if you have just the kind of visceral, you know, Howard and I, if you heard us talk, it would be so abstract, you wouldn't really know what we were talking about, I don't think. And yet we do know what we're talking about, and we don't have to talk a lot, you know. It's just, and it's an understanding, too. I mean, we both come from Toronto. We both knew each other when we were kids there. So we have very similar, we have reference points that are mutual and so on. And we started our careers, really, in movies together, basically. The Brood was I think only his second movie that he had composed music for, and it was the first movie that I had music composed specifically for. So, once again, it's our understanding of what music does for a movie. It is not there to just hammer you over the head with what's already on screen, or to make up deficits in emotion that you felt you should have had and you didn't have. It's to add a whole other level of discourse, you know, to a whole other element that would make it quite a different movie if you didn't have that music. That's what we try to do.
And what do you think his work in this film particular brings out in it?
Well, the music is basically it's based on Wagner's opera Siegfried, and that comes once again from within the movie. That, you know, with Howard and I, we don't sort of impose an abstract idea on a movie and kind of brand it and imprison it. We want the movie to tell us what it needs in terms of music, and it comes organically from inside the movie. And in this case, there is discussion between the main characters, between Kira and Michael, about Wagner and about Siegfried and about the myth of the hero born out of sin and all of that. And as I say, those were not abstract ideas for Sabina Spielrein and Jung. These were real. I mean, she really basically wanted to have his baby and wanted it to be Siegfried, the Wagnerian hero, you know. So this was our key to the movie, for the music. And so it all comes out of that, and it feels very Wagnerian, and often it actually is Wagner.
you go, I have to ask one quick movie geek question. I would be remiss if I didn't. I've been flooded with emails to ask you, is there some plan you have to revisit The Fly?
I've actually written a sort of, I guess you'd call it a kind of a sequel to The Fly, because Fox was kind of interested in that. I don't know that they're interested in it enough to make it. So I would be happy to do it. Why don't you flood Fox with emails demanding?
We will do that.
Yeah, do that.
One of my all-time favorite films, so I will certainly put together that campaign.
I'm back. How have you been? I've been talking to the hair director about finding some work for you. I told him you'd always been interested in medicine, so he suggested you might like to assist me occasionally in my research. We're quite short-staffed, so it would certainly be a help to me.
Okay, that is director David Cronenberg. His new film is A Dangerous Method, opening up in limited release on Wednesday the 23rd and wider in the weeks and months ahead. It's interesting to me how he works.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of material he chooses.
Right.
You know, we talked about this a little bit on Wednesday. That, I mean, there's a definite theme, and he recognized it early on in his career, that he was responsible for kind of exploring the body horror.
Right.
In his films. And in a way, I mean, A Dangerous Method is an expression of that as well, because it's about the kind of the connections between the mind and the body.
Right.
And making those connections, you know. But a movie like Crash that is so puzzling and so endlessly fascinating.
Right.
I can see him looking at that and saying, I'm drawn to this, but I don't know why. So I'm going to make it and try to figure out why.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, if I asked him a question about a different movie of his, that would be my question. Like, have you figured out what Crash was about
right.
for you, you know? And I could see him reaching the end and say, you know, it's still a mystery to me, but it was a worthwhile exploration.
Right, of course, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. And if you think about Howard Shore now, his composer, so he's the main composer for both Cronenberg and Scorsese. That's not a bad place to be.
That's an awesome gig. I mean, having gotten your start on Saturday Night Live, that's a great gig. Plus
yeah.
the Lord of the Rings trilogy, I mean, beautiful music for that. I mean, this guy's just
yeah.
incredible. I mean.
Yeah, he's done well. Done well for himself. So I wanted to, tonight, there is a there's a two-part documentary on Woody Allen. It's the first comprehensive treatment of him
right.
Ever, because Woody Allen generally does not allow for access to him. This documentary does, and they on a film shoot with him, they go into his private life, they even have him open up his drawer that's filled with scraps of paper filled with his ideas that he
right.
keeps by his bedside, and they talk to everybody under the sun that's worked with him. I've read reviews of it. This comes on PBS tonight.
Mm-hmm.
It's part one, 9 p.m. Eastern. Tomorrow's part two.
Okay.
I've read reviews that say that it really gives you a great glimpse of him as an artist. Not necessarily as a man, like the man is a little more guarded.
Right. Well, yeah, yeah. That I would imagine. I don't think we're ever going to get that. But
yeah. But he, I mean, yeah. He's interesting because he always kind of downplays his own gifts and his own contribution.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering what he would feel watching this documentary. I doubt he has.
Right.
I mean, but because people talking about how much he's been an influence to them, and
right,
and he just poo-poos that whole notion.
Yeah, I don't. He's not interested in that. He doesn't feel that way. I've always gotten an impression about him. He doesn't really believe in that.
Yeah. Are you going to be watching that?
I'm going to watch Dexter and Boardwalk Empire, and we're going to record Woody Allen.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a lot of... It's Sunday night. I don't know why they do this. Sunday night, like, everything's on it. And at 9 o'clock, too, I mean.
Yeah, it all starts at the same time.
Yeah.
That's too bad. I haven't been watching Boardwalk Empire. I've been a little bored with Walk Empire. It should be spelled
Board. It's okay. It goes up and down. That's
B-O-R-E-D,
how I feel about
Empire.
The Walking Dead this season until the last episode.
I didn't see the last episode. I heard a lot of things happened in it.
Yeah, it's actually, it's picking back up again. So, but I haven't been that crazy. Until that last week's episode, I haven't been that crazy about it this season.
They say you could tell the budget cuts.
Yeah, I can, yeah. You can definitely tell the budget cuts. And I don't know if that, we'll have to see how this plays out. I know they renewed it for another season. I see this being like maybe a 3-4 season show. I really don't see. I think the comic book's still going on, but I just don't know. It seems like they got to pick it up.
Right.
They got to pick up the momentum of the story. I think this is one of those series that cannot be stationary for that long. It needs to really they need to keep moving, essentially.
Yeah. Well, I guess another big piece of movie news we should discuss. I'm trying to upload a clip from the Woody Allen thing tonight so we can play that. It wasn't uploading by the time I got done with that stream of conversation, so
right.
We'll have to come back to it. The other big thing this past week is the Natalie Wood case.
Yeah.
Wow. So they're reopening the Natalie Wood death after 30 years.
God, it's been 30 years, my God.
Yeah, 1983, right? She was doing brain scan, brainstorm.
82 or 83, I think. Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
Yeah, it was probably 82 because Brainstorm, her last movie, opened in 83.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
And she was in the process of that.
Right.
And with her co-star Christopher Walken and her husband Robert Wagner.
Right.
On a boat. She disappeared, and she was later found drowned. So, and there was always something kind of curious about the situations surrounding that night. They said that they had an argument and blah, blah, blah. And the police speculated that she was trying to tie or untie the boat to the dinghy or something and slipped and hit her head. She was small, so it wouldn't have taken her very long to drown.
Right, right.
She was also petrified of the water and always said that she feared that that would be the way she'd go.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So here comes the captain of that boat. You know, some 27 years later, he wrote a book in 2009 where he comes clean, and he said that he was told to keep silent by Robert Wagner about the exact events of that night.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Yeah. And that Robert Wagner made no efforts to look for her and actually told him not to look for her.
Right.
And they didn't actively start searching for another 4 hours. Then another guy just came forward that was in a boat across the way and heard her screaming for help and said he heard a male voice drunkenly say, just 1 second, we're gonna get you help. We're going to get out there and get you.
When did this guy come forward with this?
I just read about it today.
Okay.
Part of the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, and then her sister, Natalie Wood's sister, was on Pierce Morgan the other night. She said, look, I don't think it's murder. I don't think he pushed her.
Right.
But I do think that had he taken action earlier, that I'd still have a sister.
True.
So what does that imply? What is that? If that's a crime.
Negligence.
Yeah.
I mean, but wow, going this. This is really. I mean, when I saw you were actually the first person that posted it. That was the first I'd heard of it. I was shocked. Wow, 30 years later, and.
You know what could be the new evidence? And you're dealing with
book? Is it the guy's book that prompted this, or?
I think. Well, it came out 2 years ago, but I guess there's been media intensity. And they say the new witnesses and the new accounts have forced them to reopen it. I mean, so you're reopening an investigation based on the testimony of people that lied at the beginning of the investigation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, my God. Mm.
So if you open this investigation, I mean, what really could result from it? Was a crime committed? I don't know.
I have no idea. It'd be this is like the in some ways it mirrors the Polanski thing. It keeps going.
Yeah. Well, Polanski never ended.
Yeah, well, never
ended. I mean, it was always open.
Yeah, but this is interesting, though. I mean, what would...
And is Christopher... Will Christopher Walken take the stand?
That's going to be... That would be great if that was... if the cameras were allowed.
It was a bone. You know, there was a radio guy that does an impression like every Friday or something.
I read that, yeah.
He got in trouble because he was commenting on the case in Christopher Walken's voice, and people really thought it was Chris Walken.
Yeah, that was crazy.
It's a good impression.
I don't know. Yours is pretty damn good, though.
Nobody's going to mistake me for Chris Walken.
No, true.
Like,
but
Walken impersonators, man, for people to listen to this guy and not think it's an impersonation, that's pretty good.
Yeah, no, that is. Wow. Christopher Walken would really come on and do that.
Yeah, right.
Oh, my
yeah.
God.
He did. I think the only time he really talked about it, there was a Playboy interview he did years ago, and he went into detail about it. And he just said what the story has been. We got in a bad fight, and same thing Robert Wagner said in his autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
She went to bed. Robert Wagner went to bed, and she wasn't there. They went looking for her. But
these are the two guys who have something to lose, though. If there is new evidence in it, this would be for both of them, obviously not good, but tarnish their images or whatever.
But that, yeah, but that testimony that they both give is in direct opposition to the testimony of the other two, the captain and the one in the boat across the way.
This is, I don't know, it's a big story, in that sense. I mean, wow.
Well, there hasn't been a Hollywood scandal in a while, you know?
Right. Well, this could be the one.
And there used to be, how much was created and how much was genuine, but there used to be a lot of Hollywood scandal.
Right. Well, there is, but it's just not because it's so with the something like TMZ or something. It's so common. How do I say it? The scandal and everything is so commonplace in our society now. It really takes something so wretched and sordid to really rise to the top, if you will. What is it? The TMZ show is on like Monday through Friday on syndication.
Uh-huh.
So you have that. You have something like Drudge or whatever or Radar, And it's so commonplace that. Yeah, I hate to say it, but nothing's really that shocking. But this would be because you have two reputations, famous reputations, that are the credibility and just reputations are at stake. And that would be talk about as something that would really. What is it in this? It seems like lately no one knows how to leave gracefully, or no one can stay out of the public eye for good. This would really tarnish both of them if it does turn out that they lied. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I mean, it would really be not a great way to end your biography.
Yeah, but it does give us an opportunity to hear Christopher Walken say the word dinghy.
Yeah,
and
is there
anything? Let's take a dinghy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dinghy. I'd had too much to drink. I went to the bathroom. I took a dinghy. what was I going to say? I guess Polanski would be a Hollywood scandal, right?
Yeah.
Before that, Phil Spector.
Oh, that's a big one. I mean,
but that was the caliber of Hollywood scandal back when we just had the gossip pages,
right?
And the magazines before we had the 24-hour, entertainment news.
Yeah.
That was the level of scandal, like Fatty Arbuckle and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
That people just gravitated towards.
Mm-hmm. True.
Speaking of Hollywood scandal, here is the clip from the Woody Allen documentary tonight. I finally uploaded it.
Wow.
A good segue, huh?
It
premieres tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern on PBS. I am going to be watching this, but this is a little clip about when Woody first met Diane Keaton. Here it is.
I was sent up for a play to Gensem, and I auditioned along with a lot of young New York actresses. And that's what I did. I read. And I got the part. At the time, they were concerned because I might be too tall for Woody.
So I got up on stage, and we did one of the back-to-back thing that kids do at birthday parties. And we were just about the same height. And we looked at a number of other women during the week, but Keaton was in a class by herself.
What I remember about Woody was that he was short, and he was cute. And that's what I remembered about Woody in that day, was just that, oh, my God, he is, I just had a big crush instantly.
The three of us had a good time together.
We got along very well. We had a lot of fun.
One of the things that I always remember is, like, Woody seemed to have no discipline on stage. And he would sometimes do his impression of James Earl Jones while we were supposed to be doing during a matinee, and I would crack up and destroy the scene. That was always a lot of fun. And we would hang out and eat dinner together, and that's how I really got to know him. My game plan was really to force Woody to like me. So I was always plotting and scheming about how he could grow to see me as an attractive woman.
Okay, that's a clip from tonight's show on Woody Allen. Diane Keaton actually has a new autobiography out.
That's right, yeah.
And so all the press that's been written about it focuses on the love life of Diane Keaton.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I guess she writes about it at great length. But Woody Allen, they were together. Pacino.
Mm-hmm.
They were together for a long time.
Yeah, they were.
And I guess that relationship ended because she gave him a marriage ultimatum.
That's right, mm-hmm.
And this all went down on the set of Godfather 3.
What didn't go down on the set of Godfather 3?
Yeah. But isn't that something that you're seeing, that scene where they kind of reconcile,
mm-hmm,
their differences? And that's probably around the time that they were dissolving their, 18 or whatever year
that's
relationship,
right,
they're in.
Mm-hmm.
And then Warren Beatty. Yeah. They were together, right? Diane Keaton and Warren Beatty?
Mm-hmm.
They had a
thing?
Yeah,
that's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I guess, interesting guys, I guess.
They're very, each in their own way, titanic personalities. I mean, those are really three iconic, call it three iconic men of the 20th century as far as film.
And she's done them all.
And she has done them all. No, and that's what makes her very interesting. It's a shame that, that's what I think made Manhattan Murder Mystery so cool, is it was their first movie together in a while. And it's a shame. I wish that he would work with her again, because they have such incredible chemistry. It would be wonderful to see Diane Keaton and Woody Allen in a film together. A woman his own age. That would just be wonderful.
Well, if you remember, it wasn't supposed to be a reunion for Manhattan Murder Mystery.
I know, yeah. Well,
it was supposed to be he and Mia Farrow, and then all this stuff went down, and she quit, so he brought in Diane Keaton last minute. So I guess there was something made about Woody Allen years ago, and on the heels of the scandal, and Mia Farrow said, "I don't want any of my clips used from any of his films." And they did something like, nearly a dozen movies together.
Wow.
So the director of this went back to her, and I guess enough time had passed, and she said, yeah, use whatever you want. I mean, guys, without those – and apparently also another interesting point, Woody Allen doesn't have any unused footage. Like, he doesn't keep outtakes, no behind-the-scenes stuff. It's all incinerated. He actually would hire somebody to incinerate all that stuff. So
really?
Yeah. So there's no other than the new behind the scenes stuff they shoot.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing available for this documentary.
Oh my God.
But there is, they do cover his stand up, and he was a funny stand-up.
Oh, he was hilarious when he was on Carson. Oh my God, he was hysterical.
And when he used to double on the Dick Cavett show, he used to guest and he hosted.
Yeah.
his conversation with Billy Graham on the Dick Cavett Show is great. Woody Allen interviews Billy Graham. Yeah.
That's what I love that scene in Stardust Memories when they the aliens are like, go back to your funny stuff. Everyone
right.
loves that. I love that part of the movie. I mean,
and that's one of his favorite movies, and that's one of them that's known. That's probably the first one that's known as his dud.
True. I've always loved that movie. It's just a great movie.
But I do think that artists tend to treasure most their films that don't perform, that aren't loved by the masses,
mm-hmm.
and they tend to disregard the ones that are. I think that he kind of disregards Annie Hall in Manhattan.
I think that's a possibility. It reminds me, there was a couple of years ago, and I think we might have talked about it on the show. It's a great French movie, Father of My Children.
Right.
And the father owns this, like, you know, production company, and there are all these famous French filmmakers there, and the daughter comes in, is talking to one of the guys, and says how awesome this guy's, like film was, and it was early in his career, and he goes, you know, I don't really look at that. You know, I was this early in my life, I didn't know what I was talking about, not one of my favorites, you know, and that
right.
kind of reminds me of what you're saying here. I do think there is a public... The public perception and the artist perception is completely different.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a parent, do you love the ugly kid more?
That's a good question, Jamie. We could.
I don't know.
That's a whole other show we could do. I mean,
do you love the kid that nobody likes more?
Because
you feel more protective.
A lot.
Yeah, I don't know. Is there a parallel? I'm not sure. No, I'm not a parent. I'm not a parent, nor have I ever been an ugly child. So thank you. We have a call, unlisted number, but I'm going to pick up the line. Caller, are you there? Okay.
All right.
Thank you for calling.
Maybe
he's calling just
number.
To listen in. Maybe he's just calling to listen in. Okay. Wednesday night, I think we're going to be back Wednesday night because we got a couple of interviews in the can that I need to get out.
Okay.
That sounded nasty, what I just said, didn't it? We have an interview about an upcoming book on Arthur Penn. Oh, it's actually available now, a book on Arthur Penn
mm-hmm.
and a book on Raoul Walsh. So I think we're going to do two director profiles back-to-back on Wednesday night
mm-hmm.
and cover movie news and that kind of stuff. And then Thanksgiving, Thursday.
Right, yeah.
Yes. You got big family?
Everyone will be home for the holidays, so that would be good. How about you?
Yeah, immediate family.
Yeah, just for the immediate family. Nothing. That's all I have is immediate family, nothing else. So.
Yeah. So that it'll be nice. We're doubling it up with my brother's birthday, which is a couple days
cool.
later. So it's going to be a Thanksgiving/birthday celebration.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating.
No, that is.
Kind of,
that's awesome, dude. That's a good
kind
Thanksgiving is probably my favorite holiday of the year, so, I mean...
Really?
Yeah. And I was reading this article today that no one really, you know, it's become... Because, you know, they have the Black Friday. All the stores now, like Thursday night, they're opening, like, you know, Best Buy, and other stores are having their Black Friday specials, you know?
Yeah.
Starting, like, Thursday night. I don't know about you. The last thing I want to do after Thanksgiving dinner is go shopping. I'm sorry.
No, you
want to
sleep. You want to watch football and sleep. I've never done the Black Friday thing.
I've worked Black Friday. It's not fun, but...
I mean, I know people that camp. People are camping out at certain places now, I read.
Oh, my God.
But they're starting earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer like an emphasis completely on Black Friday.
No, it's
Why
not.
Are we talking about this? I don't really... Favorite holiday films. Is there a favorite holiday film?
A holiday for you mean Thanksgiving or any
this season?
This year so far or
No. This a holiday season film. Film about the holiday season.
Well, I mean, come on, there's, you know, National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. What more could you ask for?
That's it. Yeah.
And Elf, Bad Santa. Bad Santa has to be up there, but I would have to say the best, I think one of the all-time best is Love Actually.
Oh, that's a good one.
That's just, that really, I mean, all those, that year, you had Love Actually, Elf, and Bad Santa. And I would say that all three of those have caught on every year. It's like something people watch a lot of. I mean, I put those right up there.
Yeah.
Like the Christmas Story, you know, definitely.
Yeah. You left out the Bohemoth.
You mean, oh, It's a Wonderful Life?
Yeah.
Dude, that's a given. I mean, come on.
Yeah, I guess it is, isn't
it? It's really, I mean, it is an awesome film. And there's Home, someone mentioned Home Alone. I would put the first Home Alone in there, certainly.
Yeah.
Let's see what else. The Die Hard movies. The first Die Hard Christmas movie. I'm sorry. No,
back
it is.
When,
come
back
on.
When Bruce Willis used to be thankful for hair. It's Home for the Holidays, the Jodie Foster movie.
That's a good one. I like that. That's a good one.
Yeah. I don't watch holiday movies in the holiday. It's not a tradition of mine, really.
No, but it's when they're on. I mean, I like to watch them when they're on, but I'm trying to think, is there anything, I mean, a lot of the recent stuff, I mean, what was that one with Paul Giamatti and Vince Vaughn? That was just god-awful.
That was a Santa Claus thing.
I mean, they're sorry they made that. I mean, they're burning all the film stock of that right now.
Yeah, like Giamatti played Santa Claus.
Yeah, and then his brother Vince Vaughn played Fred Claus or something. Yeah, Fred Claus. It was, God, I mean, yeah, come on. That's not going to be shown every Christmas. Oh, yeah, Four Christmases was awful, too.
Yeah, it was. But you could tell it was, like, we had that director on when he was in the middle of shooting it.
Yeah.
Because he came on to talk about A Fistful of Quarters, which I want to see that documentary again.
That's a great documentary.
I love that movie. And so we're talking to him about that, and I asked him about Four Christmases, and you could tell he thought it sucked.
Yeah.
He really wanted it in the interview as soon as I asked him about that.
Yeah.
Which is a shame. I mean, they're working with, you know, top stars and Robert Duvall and... Anyway,
yeah,
but he
was in that. I mean, in it.
Yeah.
I've only watched parts of it on cable, and that's all I think I will watch of it.
Same here.
Yeah.
Miracle on 34th Street.
Oh yeah, that's a good one.
The Santa Claus. Always room for Martin Short during the holidays.
The Santa Claus is the one with Tim Allen, right?
Always room for Tim Allen. Like I said, always.
Yeah, there's always
room
for Tim Allen. Yeah. yeah, that. They made three of those. They managed to crank out three of those.
Wow. But is that a sound? I guess they don't make a lot of holiday movies because they're only relevant one time a year.
True.
But
yeah.
But like music, like albums, like you'll see a lot of artists come out with a Christmas album because they know that it pays dividends year after year after year.
Oh
after
yeah.
Year.
Mm-hmm.
So would studios approach Christmas movies the same way? I don't know.
Well, it depends. I mean, it
doesn't cost
$80 million
to make an album.
If they take off, they will then have a very long shelf life. But that's a gamble, though. I think it's a big, you know, Aaron in chat room says Silent Night, Deadly Night. Oh, definitely, you have to include those.
That's right.
You really do. That's all I can really think of right now. Like, I forgot about the Tim Allen movies, and there's a reason why. Brings us to someone brought up in the chat room, New Year's Eve, the newest Gary Marshall movie that's coming out. That's, I guess, like, by the people who brought you Valentine's Day. I mean, is that a threat or a promise? What? I mean...
same director.
Yeah.
They're going to run out of special days. I told people that Gary Marshall's next movie will be called Tax Day. April 15th, and you know, everybody running to get their taxes done. I don't know. I saw the preview in front of something last week. I mean, star heavy. I mean, not since Irwin Allen. It's just as much of a disaster movie, probably, as something Irwin Allen would do.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
Everyone Under the Sun, and probably one scene with De Niro, it looks like.
Yeah.
In that movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't. You know, they're both of those movies that they're trying so hard to rip off Love Actually, and they can't. That's the one thing I think the British do very. I mean, they do a lot of things well, but those movies, their romantic comedies, are like so much better than the ones we've been making. But I think Love Actually was really like the best of all of those. They took every great British actor, and it was just awesome.
You know, I love the movie they did right before Love Actually too, which was Notting Hill.
That's a really good, I like that one too.
I do love that movie, but it does suffer from, the one drawback of that movie for me is that it plays too much like a music video montage at times.
Right.
Like, it's just one music montage after another. And it feels a little lazy. I mean, Elvis Costello provides the music montages for the most part, so that's fine. But
right.
But I thought it was a completely charismatic movie, which is what you have to have when you make a love story, I think.
Right. Totally.
And Love Actually is filled with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you're right. It's good stuff.
Yeah.
Let's play another film score I should have gotten to the other night. This is from Tower Heist.
There you go. Not a bad movie. Much better than we already talked about it, but not a bad movie.
Yeah. Tower Heist. Okay.
It's coming and gone already.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll play this clip and then we'll get to some other movie news before we close out the show tonight.
Okay.
I got to check our Twitter page if you could.
Yeah, sure. Oh, yeah, sure.
Because my computer will freeze if I check
okay,
it.
Yeah, okay, I'll do that right now.
And that'll give us some movie headline ideas. Here's Tower Heist. Okay, that's Christoph Beck, as Team Sheila just told us in the chat room. Tower Heist, the film score is available now. And you also heard A Dangerous Method a little bit earlier during the Cronenberg interview. That's Howard Shore. That's available, I think, next month, but you can order it now. And then Wednesday night, maybe we'll play the score to The Artist.
Oh,
the
cool.
Artiste. Yes. The Descendant score. I think it's all Hawaiian.
It is. It is all. It is all Hawaiian. We saw it yesterday. It's a really good movie. It's really well done. If he's going to be nominated for it. I mean, I actually think all the performances all around are really good. But it's a really good movie. Very emotional. And quite the emotional punch at the end.
Right up there with Payne's Best, Alexander Payne's Best movie.
I would say so. I would say definitely. I mean, I like Election a lot and Sideways a lot, and this is definitely up there, if not better, I think. I mean, Clooney it's really interesting. We watched that, and then Ocean's 11 was on last night, and I watched that again because I hadn't seen that in a long time. And Clooney can do it all. He's really just, ever since Out of Sight, you know, Soderbergh knew what to do with him, and he's just incredible. But that, watching Ocean's 11, I forgot how much fun that movie, the first one. I like all of them, but the first one especially. Oh my God, just such a funny movie. But no, going back to The Descendants, he gives these masterful performances in this, and I think also Up in the Air and Michael Clayton. And, you know, if Daniel Day-Lewis did not do There Will Be Blood, I think Clooney would have walked away with Michael Clayton.
Right.
For sure. And who was it that won the
year? Well, it's good that Clooney did this movie this year, because if he did it next year, he'd have to run against Daniel Day-Lewis and Lincoln.
Oh,
right?
God. Well, right there.
And
that's
the behemoth right there.
Yeah,
jeez.
That's going to be huge. This is his year, though. But there are other great performances, but I do think that they're going to be pushing very hard, and I think he might very well. And the movie's done incredibly well. Broke the top 10 at number 10.
Limited screen.
In 29 theaters or something?
Wow. Good.
That's incredible.
Good, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
This is The Descendant score. Right, so we'll play some more of that next time. Well, Aaron was telling me about some other horror movies. So Jack Frost, Christmas movies, horror movies.
Yeah.
Jack Frost, not the Michael Keaton version, even though that is a scary movie. any movie that has You Da Man, No I Da Snowman is pretty horrifying.
You're right.
Black Christmas. I mean,
oh,
there's
that's
two
right.
of those, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The original and the remake, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. I forgot all about those. I forgot about it. Yeah, I mean,
that remake was actually on TV the other night, and I had it turned on for whatever, God knows what reason. That's all I have to say about that, really.
Yeah, okay. Though the other thing we should talk about is that you did have on the Twitter feed about the 15 documentaries that are up for, that are narrowed down, I guess, for the Academy.
Yeah.
What do we have here? These are the features that have advanced so far. The Battle for Brooklyn, Bill Cunningham, New York, Buck, Hell and Back Again, If a Tree Falls, A Story of the Earth Liberation Front. Wow, some of these didn't even come here. Jane's Journey, The Loving Story, Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory, Pina, Project Nim, Semper Fi, Sing Your Song, Undefeated, Under Fire, Journalists in Combat, and We Were Here.
Mm.
This is very interesting. There's not really Project Nim or Bill Cunningham.
Sure.
Would be the two of the most popular, but there are others like Paradise Lost 3, I would imagine, might have some momentum.
You know, sadly, I've only seen one of these movies.
I haven't seen any of them, unfortunately, so...
And you'll never guess which one I've seen.
Buck.
Sing Your Song is the only one I've seen.
Really? Okay.
And that's the life story of Harry Belafonte.
Well, that was the one that was on HBO, right?
Yeah, Harry Belafonte.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought Buck, because Buck was playing for a long time, you know, so I didn't know.
Yeah.
I just didn't know.
And Buck is, of course, the life story of Buck Rogers.
Oh, God. There you go, folks.
It's not really. So what are they missing? I know there are people that are ticked off about it, as they always are with
right.
documentaries. So this is the pool of 15 films that they narrowed it down from in which to pick their 5 nominees. And they're historically terrible documentaries. The Academy. They really
are.
Yeah. I know that they're missing some, and I'm looking at the headline right now.
Yeah, I don't know which one.
No tabloid. Errol
right.
Morris.
Mm-hmm.
No, Into the Abyss, which is the I think that's the name of it, the Werner Herzog.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Or you mean? No. Oh no, Cave of Forgotten Dreams, or.
No, that's one, but the new one about the death penalty
that just came out with. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And no page one inside the New York Times.
Oh, that is a huge omission right there.
That is the one right there, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Why? I mean, what is the criteria?
I don't have to be
a movie no one's heard of in order to be nominated for that?
Oh, my God. I think you may be right there. Actually, there is something that caught my eye on the Twitter feed, and I don't know anything about it. This is the first I've seen of it. So the Super 8 casting associate revealed as registered sex offender.
Yeah, and you know when I posted that feed that Sean Levy responded to it?
What, really?
Yeah.
What did he respond? Wait, to that? Or?
Yeah, he said, Entertainment Weekly, EW is an appropriate source for that story. And he said it sarcastically because... And I understand. But
right.
That's where I saw the article. And to be honest, it doesn't say anything that the LA Times article didn't say. And they sourced the LA Times in the very first paragraph. So, I mean, they sourced someone reputable
right
off the top if you don't think EW is reputable. But, yeah, there's a registered sex offender that's been working his way up the Hollywood ladder into casting. And he cast all the children for Super 8. J.J. Abrams just found out about it, and he's made a statement that he's horrified. And
oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow. That is very horrifying, actually. I mean...
Yeah. Yeah, what'd he say? I don't know if he's... If the sex offender has broken whatever restrictions are on him by doing that. I don't know.
I would imagine, though... I mean, it got...
And I don't know what kind of sex offender he is. I don't know.
It can't be good. I mean,
yeah.
I don't mean to be facetious, but it just can't. Wow. I mean.
Yeah. Anything children and sex offender, that's never good. I mean, that's not a good combination.
Yeah, never a good. Yeah.
And Super 8, that's even worse.
Damn, man, that's just harsh. I mean, this is really harsh. I mean. Oh my God! Okay, what else? What else do you?
What else is on the Twitter feed? If you want to follow us on Twitter, you
can follow
do
us
so.
On Twitter. Well, those are the things that really stood out. I mean,
you can do so at twitter.com/moviegeeksunite. There's no room for the D on Twitter.
Yeah, there's no room.
So we're missing our D there. But if you want to, and we got a lot of movie news that we post on there every single day, like 20 to 30 stories a day sometimes. But if you want to follow us on Facebook instead, you can do so at Movie Geeks United there at Facebook. And if you missed any part of the Cronenberg interview tonight, it took place in the first half hour of the show. You can tune back in on replay. It'll be there.
I'm just looking to – oh, this is something I did not know. This is courtesy of Cinema Blend, and I don't know what to make of this. Speaking of George Clooney, he wants to play Steve Jobs in a biopic. And I just don't know how I feel about a biopic about Steve Jobs, to be very honest with you.
Yeah. I mean, we've had many biopic. I mean, wasn't the Silicon Valley the Kings of, or whatever that was?
I don't know. I honestly don't
the
know.
Anthony Michael Hall movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. There have been a couple. But I don't... Wow, this is because is it? I guess this is going to be based on the Walter Isaacson book, and okay, it is. And you know, in this portrayal, you know, Steve Jobs, we get to see or as close as we can, I mean, the real Steve Jobs, and not always not the guy we see at the Apple, how should I say it, press conferences, at the meetings where they launch stuff and everything. We will get to see the real Steve Jobs, supposedly, and I'm very, and, you know, not always a likable person. So I'd be very, I mean, you're curious. We like Clooney so much. This would actually be, I think, be very interesting to see how this plays.
You know something else about Steve Jobs that a lot of people don't want to cop to?
Mm-hmm.
You know what he said changed his life and opened up his perception enough to be the innovator that he was?
What?
LSD.
he wouldn't be the first.
Yeah, but isn't it funny that in all those tributes about his genius that you won't read that?
Right.
Yeah, I'm not advocating LSD. I'm like the most drugless person on the
yeah,
planet.
Yeah, no. I understand that. No, it's just I work with people. Apple is one of our clients, but I work with people who worship Steve Jobs, and it's kind of frightening. It's just very frightening.
In terms of people that have shaped the world.
He has. I mean, there's no doubt about it. He has shaped the world. I mean, and I'd be very curious to see how that plays out. I still need to read the book, and I'll probably read it in paperback. But I am interested. I have an iPhone, and I use Apple products at work every day. And they're awesome products. There's no doubt about it. What he did and what he told his engineers and all the people, I mean, there are a lot of great people work at Apple. I think that's my problem, actually, with when he passed away, was that people were so focused on him. But he had all these people. He was able to tell that, you know, he, in many ways, he's like George Lucas. He's a great idea man, a showman. But there are people underneath him who were able to bring his ideas to full circle. And, you know, and that's what I have a problem with. My brother had a problem with that, too. He had all these brilliant engineers, this great crew.
Right.
And that gets lost, I think, sometimes when people talk about Steve Jobs.
Is that his fault that it got lost, though? I don't know. I never really paid attention to interviews with him. I mean, was he the kind of person to give credit to his team for realizing
that? That I don't know. I can't give you an honest answer right now because I don't know because I just sort of I sort of
because
tune out when
the press it. And the press is going to be reductive, you know, in general.
Yeah.
But
mm-hmm.
You know what movie is 30 years old this year?
Which one?
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
That's right. And that you have that piece about the argument to dislike.
Yeah.
Raiders. And what was that?
It's not my argument.
I know it's not your argument. It was posted in the Chicago Tribune. But what was the...
Michael Phillips, I guess, was the critic that never really liked Raiders of the Lost Ark. There is a streak of people that think that it's it's impersonal. It's just a highlight reel of every old school adventure film ever made. There's no time to breathe. But this, I mean, Michael Phillips goes as far as to say that Indiana Jones is not a good character. What?
I don't know about that. I disagree with that completely. But all those things that you said, there's no time to breathe, that's all true. But it works to the film's, you know, to enjoyment. And I think that was nonstop. That's what was so beautiful about it.
Yeah. I remember first seeing Raiders of the Lost Ark as a kid. I remember opening day, going to that opening Saturday with my brother, riding our bikes up to the theater and seeing. I mean, I have vivid memories of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, wanting to have a hat and a bullwhip after.
Yeah.
So I could,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it informed, you know, my dream fantasies as a kid, as I'm sure it did millions of kids.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Now, I mean, nowadays, do kids pretend like they're Transformers? I mean, what do the kids do now?
I honestly don't know. I don't think it's changed in that regard. I think there are things. I don't know if it's Transformers, but I still think you have that. I hope you have that still.
Yeah.
I do think you have that because there are kids. Obviously, Harry Potter is one that definitely I think would be in that.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. I cop to that. Yeah, that's
definitely.
True.
I mean, Harry Potter is, you know, definitely one of those, and I think, you know, I have no problem with that.
But, you know, Raiders was groundbreaking, obviously. And they came up with the idea on a beach. I remember Spielberg talking about it. It was Spielberg and Lucas sitting side by side on the beach or something.
Right.
And they talked about loving those old serial movies, those swashbuckling adventures, and said, we should do, like, our own modern day. And then Lucas went in the corner and wrote something out. And, yeah.
No, that's cool. That's awesome, though. I mean, it's really, yeah.
And they did not want to cast Harrison Ford.
Well, they
because
wanted Tom Selleck. Didn't they want Tom Selleck originally?
Right. Yeah, but, I mean, when Harrison Ford was even suggested, they kind of poo-pooed the idea. I said the word poo-poo, that's right.
Yeah.
And because it's Han Solo. I mean, he can't, you don't want somebody in there that's already associated with this character indelibly.
Mm-hmm.
But to Harrison Ford's credit, I mean, to be responsible for two distinct, iconic characters.
Yeah.
How many people get to do that? I mean, ask Christopher Reeve or Mark Hamill.
Yeah.
Not many.
No, true. Very true. It's a great... No, it was... And it changed his life. I mean, because if he hadn't played Indiana Jones, he might not have gotten...
Right.
...to do the other thing. So it was a definite... It's an awesome thing that Tom Selleck... Maybe not for Tom Selleck, obviously, but, I mean, High Road to China. That was the...
Lasseter.
Lasseter, Runaway.
Well, somebody has to act across from Lauren Hutton.
That's true. That's very true. But...
So, Raiders of the Lost Ark, 30 years old. Apparently, it'll be on Blu-ray next year. A DVD will come out this year, mm-hmm. if it hasn't already. And it's screening, a remastered cut of it screening in Chicago, and I guess it'll be touring the country, maybe.
Oh, cool.
I think so. But that Blu-ray will be nice. I still contend my favorite Indiana Jones
mm-hmm.
is Temple of Doom.
Well, that's another nonstop one. I mean,
yes.
It's a good. That actually, I think, holds up very well. I think the first three hold up very well. But that's a good one. That wasn't popular at the time, but I think as the time has been very good to that one.
Well, and my best friend, he loves Spielberg, especially Spielberg of this period.
Mm-hmm.
Loves Indiana Jones, like worships Raiders. Mm-hmm. And he completely has kind of negative feelings towards Temple of Doom. And he and I get into it whenever we talk about that. We get into it about it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It is out of character. I mean, it feels like the most different movie of the whole series.
Right.
Even the fourth one, which is a weak movie, still feels like it has the elements that make it part of that world.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Temple of Doom is just, it's the... The stuff that's scary and creepy to you as a kid, like, times a thousand. I mean, this is his Indiana Jones goes underground kind of adventure.
Well, remember, it's a prequel. It's really almost, you could say,
yeah.
how he became. You see how certain things develop, but that might be why, too. But I remember it was that film and Dune were considered the two biggest disappointments of the year.
It made a lot of money. Unlike Dune, it made a lot of money.
Oh, yeah. Well, Dune did not make a lot of money.
Yeah. I even thought then, I saw it like 8 times in the theater. I even thought then, not Dune. I'm talking about
Temple of
Doom.
No, yeah, if you saw Dune 8 times in the theater, I would say you need psychiatric help.
Now imagine if you combined the two and just made Indiana Jones and the Temple of Dune. I mean, wouldn't that have been something? I saw Temple of Doom 8 times in the theater. Even then, I thought, this is the best action movie ever made. And I still feel that way.
It's a great, I mean, it is a really awesome film, and I also love, I mean, there's just so many great moments in that movie. I love, like, the scene on the rope bridge at the end. That's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Spielberg used to be that kind of director, where he could kind of make your childhood fantasies come to life on screen.
Now, do you say that, in a negative way now, that he doesn't make those kind of films really anymore? Or?
I think he's different. And that's not a...
You don't expect him to make.
Criticism necessarily. I mean, people mature.
Yeah.
Artists mature.
I mean, not everyone can be, you know... Let's say like this. Do you want George Lucas, essentially, to make this...
Well, let me take that back. Not everyone matures.
Yeah. I mean, that's the funny thing. I mean, as a lot of people pointed out with The Phantom Menace, you know, his directing style hasn't changed since 1977 in one sense. I mean, that's what's a frightening thing is, although the original Star Wars had a lot more going for it, obviously. We hadn't seen anything like that. And the reason the other two were good is because he did not direct them. That's the funny thing.
And he didn't write them either. I honestly believe that's the case.
Yeah.
He didn't write Jedi. No, cast in. Write Captain, a Jedi.
Yeah,
wrote Jedi.
I mean, you had other people working on these, and that was a big help. And,
Kasdan also wrote Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about Lawrence Kasdan. Like, having a footprint in cinema history, not necessarily reflected in his own films that he'd wrote and directed.
Right.
His screenplays he wrote for others.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, they were very, he and these, and now let's talk, Kasdan is also one of these guys like who has these sons that are actually very creative and very talented.
Jake.
Isn't there another one?
Jake did Welcome to the Rileys, right?
Mm-hmm. And he directs New Girl. He did we did Bad Teacher. I'm not crazy about Bad Teacher, but who did the TV set?
Oh, that was him.
Okay, that's a great film.
That is a good film. Yeah. It's a good little indie movie.
Yeah, and didn't he do Zero Effect?
Yes.
Yeah, so I mean it's very interesting. That might be his it's his son though. I mean, wow.
Yeah.
That
well,
a great
yeah,
eye.
Taking over the mantle. Well, Larry Kasdan has a new movie that he's done. Because we talked to Richard Jenkins about it.
That's right. Okay.
When Richard Jenkins was on for Let Me In.
Mm-hmm.
And he just did it. And he said, man, it's just wonderful to say those words. And it's such a great movie for adults, for grown-ups, you know. Which people said Big Chill was. I mean, people were kind of relieved when Big Chill came out. Like, finally, a movie about our generation. We don't have to look at, you know, Return of the Jedi.
There's truth about that. I mean, there's the Big Chill, and there's and then I always like, I guess, the follow up, Grand Canyon, kind of, which is I thought very good.
You like Grand Canyon?
I do like Grand Canyon.
I know people that love that movie.
But I know there are people that hate that movie too, though.
There's a thin line for me.
Mm-hmm.
I only saw Grand Canyon once. Like, I never returned to it. But the first time I saw it, I remember thinking that it felt so incredibly pretentious. Like, it was searching for deep meaning, and it didn't find it.
I could see where you would think that. I could definitely see where you would think that.
But not pretentious in the way a Robert Redford movie is. Like, a Redford talking in bumper stickers all the time.
Right, right.
It wasn't that kind of pretentious. I don't know. I'll have to check it out again because I didn't really give it a fair shot when it first came out.
It's better than Dreamcatcher. Which just maybe.
Yeah.
Just
we should have
really
t-shirts
awful
made.
Film. Awful. I never read the book, though. I never read
t-shirts made that say that. And that can apply for most movies out there.
Yeah, it's better than Dreamcatcher.
All right, Wednesday night we'll be back to talk about Arthur Penn, the groundbreaking director of Bonnie and Clyde. There's a new book out about him, and there's also a new book about Raoul Walsh, one of the innovators, early innovators in film, made hundreds of films, tutored under D.W. Griffith. That's how far back he goes.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Wow, that's wow.
Yeah.
D.W. Griffith, wow.
Yeah, the birth of the nation, birth of a nation. I think he actually helped shoot Birth of a Nation.
Jesus Christ, wow.
Yeah.
That is incredible.
Unfortunately, he was unavailable for the interview, but
yeah,
the person that wrote his biography is. So. And throughout the rest of the month, interesting, Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
So we have David Cronenberg.
Right.
Could we get three different diverse guests?
Right.
David Cronenberg, Dane Cook, Rennie Harlan.
Wow. Dane Cook and Rennie Harlan. Wow. You couldn't ask for three more diverse. That's incredible.
Yeah. I was thinking to myself, man, that Rennie Harlan stands out. I want to get another D guest. Dolph Lundgren, like, can we get him back on?
Oh, he was
and, you know,
great.
Dolph Lundgren has like a 4-page spread in Entertainment Weekly this week, an article.
Oh, okay.
Dolph Lundgren, man, come on.
Good for him, man. Does he mention us?
No, he doesn't. Sorry. I remember doing that interview.
Yeah.
I remember going home on my lunch break and talking to Dolph. Expendables 2, yeah.
Wow, okay.
That'll be coming out August of next year. Every action star on the planet in that movie.
Mm-hmm. That is going to be wild.
Yeah. Stuntman was already killed on that set. That's hard. That must be hard to deal with.
That is, yeah.
You know, being a stuntman and the film you die on is Expendables 2.
Okay. All right, you said it, not me.
That's terrible. I did say it. I probably should have said that. But
no, you shouldn't have said
that. But I mean, it's an incredibly challenging job, but I wonder the circumstances surrounding that. I felt, obviously, the tragedy, I know the tragedy is that someone died on any film set now.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing with Transformers 3. I mean, there's a woman that was an extra, and now she's, I don't know if she's passed, but she's essentially brain dead or on life support or something.
Ooh,
because
that's awful.
She was hit by debris, you know?
Ooh.
There's somebody that just did an extra part in the Chicago street.
Right. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Dangerous stuff. And then you look at a Cameron movie.
Yeah.
Like a Titanic.
Right.
Nobody got hurt on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so how could you possibly mount a movie like Titanic? And that tells you what a meticulous director James Cameron is.
Mm-hmm. True.
Because no one got hurt. And the whole padding. Remember the boat? Like, of course you do. It's the most popular movie ever.
Yeah.
The boat when it breaks in two and it like upsides and everyone's falling like vertically. Can you imagine the padding that had to be placed for that to happen?
I know. Wow.
And that was done for real. For
mm-hmm.
reals, dude.
For real.
All right. We're gonna go. But we'll close off the show. Let's see. Let's close off the show with another piece of film. No, let's close off the show with some score for Fireflies in the Garden.
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah. That's the new Julia Roberts movie. We talked to the director of that a couple weeks ago. All right, dude. I'll see you back here Wednesday night.
Okay, cool, man.
Have a good one. Thanks, guys.
Have a good night, everyone. Thanks.
Bye-bye.